public involvement document regarding the discussions that we had before the application was submitted. So I just wanted to mention that that was because that was before the application was submitted, and also to thank the Mount Sabre Neighborhood Association for your constructive participation in the pre-application discussions with the Water Bureau. I want to thank the Water Bureau for their tours, which I participated in, and the really collaborative and helpful input that we received from neighbors to modify, that the Water Bureau received to modify their application. It's good to hear us coming here to argue about the conditions rather than, as was clarified by Ms. Adam, that you're not asking for the approval to be rescinded or for us not to approve. So I just wanted to make that clear, to check on that too, that you're asking for the conditions, you're not asking for us to reject the application.
No, we're asking for you to uphold the HLC decision and to, as you'll see in our documents, to possibly strengthen them and with some refinements that we've suggested. And there is one public process that we do feel we missed that we've also asked for in our appeal.
Yes, I saw that. But you didn't discuss that in your testimony just now. I was wondering about that.
If you'd like to know more about that, I'm happy to speak to that. It's the conditional use review. We do feel that this project triggered a conditional use review, and that seems to be a difference of reading the technicalities of how the code is written. Right now, for instance, in the presentation you saw from BDS, they said that the development has not actually expanded beyond 1,500 square feet, and we argue that the development has expanded beyond 1,500 square feet. Water Bureau asserted that development that's happening below ground is not normally considered development, and we are arguing that when below ground development has above ground implications, as it does in this case, the pipe restricts trees from being planted in our tree park, that we have then hit the trigger that would start the conditional use process, which is designed to evaluate whether or not a project changes the character of a site. And changing tree planting restrictions in this park does potentially affect the character of this park.
The Water Bureau has introduced an assertion that's never been historically true in Mount Tabor Park. They're now saying that above their pipe and for 10 feet in each direction, no trees can be planted ever, forever and ever. Amen. That's, of course, not true anywhere else in the city where pipes run underneath trees and infrastructure and streets and buildings everywhere. But they're saying, they're now asserting in Mount Tabor Park that trees cannot be planted above any of their pipes. So, for instance, taking the trees out of Mount Tabor, that the trees that they are going to have to cut down, they will be mitigated. Even if they're taking mature trees, they're going to because they're eliminating some areas of Mount Tabor that can be planted with trees, the mitigation has to be saplings planted as street trees elsewhere in the city and can't be planted in Mount Tabor Park there because they won't allow trees to be planted above their pipe. Right now, there are the same diameter pipes in Mount Tabor with trees growing above them, but Water Bureau is asserting that it now has the use of that land in perpetuity above its pipes, and that changes the character of the park, and that's why we wanted conditional use.
So, and the tree planting is something that you think would be better addressed using the conditional use approval criteria?
Yes.
I see. And then could you also, when you come back for a response, address their proposed changed wording to condition B as to whether you think that that's acceptable or if you have a counter proposal. Thank you.
Commissioner Fritz, can I add one comment to what your comments earlier? I want to also thank Commissioner Fritz, Stephanie and John, and others from the Neighborhood Association. When this first came to me, I believe it had been determined to be a type 2 land use proceeding. And I believe based on the feedback we got, we made it a type 3. There's originally an administrative decision. I was persuaded, based on the arguments of the neighborhood, that type 3 would give a more robust public process. I appreciate the arguments that you made to that effect and Commissioner Fritz. I thought it was the right thing to do. I also appreciate the work that the Neighborhood Association and committee members did as part of that citizen panel. And it is... somewhat unprecedented for parks and water to work this collaboratively, and I thank the commissioner in charge for setting that standard.
Thank you, Commissioner. Certainly our staff have all done a good job. Finally, when you come back, supposing we don't agree with you on the issue of the conditional use, and you can do this in written testimony as well before the record closes, are there some additional conditions addressing trees that you would like to see that might address the concern directly rather than going through the conditional use process? Because I'm really encouraged that we seem very close to figuring out something that might work, and so I'm hoping we can do that in this process.
That would be great.
Other questions? Thank you very much. We'll see you back here in a while.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you.
Okay.
I know we are ready to move to response now, but I also heard from Ms. Adam that we have some members of the Landmarks Commission here. Checking with our city attorney, it might be appropriate to give them the chance, or the opportunity if they want to speak now as opposed to after response. What do you think?
If we were doing this as a typical appeal, we would generally give them the courtesy of being the first ones to testify as part of public testimony, but not typically in between the appellant and the response.
All right.
I won't be that courteous then.
Sorry. These volunteers give us a huge amount of their time. I was trying to save them a little of it, but we'll make them wait another 20 minutes because I think you're correct. Okay. Let's move to now 10 minutes for response from the Water Bureau to the Mount Tabor Neighborhood Association's appeal and their statement.
I'm Teresa Elliott, and with me are Kristen and Tom to respond to the public testimony and to also to the other appellants' comments. Our public outreach was scaled appropriately for the size of the project and the level of construction impacts. The design does not significantly alter the historic structures and minimizes impacts on the historic districts, so the outreach was focused on construction impacts. Early in 2014, we modified that outreach to accommodate the higher levels of interest from the neighbors and the community groups. We set up walking tours to explain the project, and we set up and participated in a community advisory committee to look at options to reduce construction impacts on the parks and the neighbors. We submitted a report today that summarizes that outreach. As an example of the changes the Water Bureau made to address public comments, pipe alignments in three locations were modified to increase the number of trees being saved and protected. Photos on the right show trees below Reservoir 1 that were saved by realigning one of the pipelines. We expect to continue to use the site as a basic utility, and the proposal is completely reversible. The Water Bureau chose to commission the Historic Structures Report in 2009 in order to identify, prioritize, and select potential projects. Some of this work has already been done, and we'll show you some examples of that in a moment. The report offers multiple options on many historic restorations or repair items and provides cost estimates for some items, initially having a planning-level cost estimate of $1.5 million. Nowhere in the report does it suggest removing non-historic elements. We cannot remove the non-historic elements and be able to operate the system. The Water Bureau has attached cost estimates to the things that were missing in the report and updated the cost to $2018 dollars needed in order to comply with Condition E. We estimate that the complete work in the report would cost at least $8 million. Removal of the non-historic items are not included in that estimate and would be expensive and would require additional historic reviews. This would also result in removal of critical infrastructure, such as the Tabor pump stations, which are not historic but are still in use.
I want to touch on some of the ongoing work that's occurred in the last decade or so at Mount Tabor so I can illustrate the specialization that is required to work on contributing resources. So for the first slide here shows gatehouses. Gatehouse 1, shown in the pictures on the left, has a patented finish by Ernest Ransom. It is concrete, but it's designed to look like stone. The surface is highly rusticated and hand-finished. And a series of molds were created of these rusticated blocks so that the surface could be replicated. And those blocks were slightly curved at the two ends, you know, by the shape of the gatehouse, and then had to be flat in the middle areas. The photos on the bottom right show that the sills were completely recast. Cornice details were also recast using what you see there are epoxy negatives. The concrete color and aggregate needed to be matched exactly, and contractors had to be specialists in this type of work. The Reservoir 1 equipment platform and gatehouse platform, which you see in that lowest left-hand photo, were both also replaced or rebuilt at that time, and those pieces of work needed historic design review. The historic structures report had a planning level cost for this item, but the true cost of the work ended up being about four times the planning cost estimate. Now, at the upper right, you see Gatehouse 5, which received new handrails for accessibility. The steps were patched and restored. Doors, door frames, and windows were replaced or rebuilt all in 2008 to 2010. And again, that work did require historic design review. Next slide here is for concrete work at reservoir basins and perimeter walkways. There's been much ongoing basin work. All of them have been patched and cleaned of debris on a regular basis, but then concrete repairs plus liner was added to Reservoir 5 in the 1990s, and there have been major linings many decades in a row. In 1965 and 1975, there are many photos that show up when you just look through city archives of those photos. So they're occurring on a regular basis as needed. Sidewalks were extensively repaired around all three reservoirs in the 2008-2010 project under a separate historic review. To meet the approval criteria, which is based on the Secretary of the Interior standards for historic structures, sidewalks have to retain their original width and simple scoring pattern of the original design. With the root damage, freeze and thaw cycles, pipe access, et cetera, much of the sidewalk surfaces have needed repair or replacement over time. And this type of work is less historically demanding, so a specialized contractor isn't always necessary, but the concrete does have to match the appearance of the original in color and aggregate as much as possible. So the bottom right photo shows concrete samples being visually evaluated for a match with historic concrete. Even putting in a curb cut can trigger review in a historic district. And then as a final example, I have some historic wrought iron work that's been done at Mount Tabor. Wrought iron is another historically sensitive type of repair and rehabilitation. It is very decorative, and it's an important character-defining element of all three reservoirs. The restoration of the Reservoir 1 fence was a major repair done in the 2008-2010 timeframe. Work had to be done off-site for several reasons. One is environmental concerns with any sanding or scraping of paint that might contain lead. So small areas can be contained and done on-site, but any larger repair has to be removed from the site in sections and then brought back to the site and reattached. So the fence was actually cast into the parapet wall originally. So it has to be cut off and then reinstalled using a new sleeve detail. The examples of restoration work I showed in these three slides provide a glimpse into the high bar that is set by historic approval criteria and by the state and federal oversight of work in historic districts. The Water Bureau does take this work seriously, in my professional opinion.
So in summary, we have discussed Condition B and the technical reasons that we cannot meet the specific number of day limitation that has been provided in the condition. We've also provided detailed written responses elsewhere to the appeal arguments of the Mount Tabor Neighborhood Association, and it would be worth your while to check those in addition to what we are presenting here. But this is about the zoning code, and the zoning code reviews specific proposals at specific properties and their effects. And that is really what it deals with. And the changes that we are proposing, the physical changes to the property, which is the development that we are proposing, are small, very small in scale, and they maintain the visual and historic character of the site. And in fact, the Landmarks Commission stated in their findings that the proposed work, quote, preserves the essential form and integrity of the Reservoirs Historic District and Mount Tabor Park, unquote. So, nevertheless, they are asking to impose Condition E, which we believe is unjustified, and we believe that a land use decision, condition of approval, is not the right place to create a program of this sort. From the beginning, we carried out this project with the knowledge that Council had budgeted a separate project to plan for the future of the reservoirs in the park. And our proposal preserves all options for the future use of these reservoirs. They could be filled and preserved. Other things could be done with them. We're not foreclosing these options. So the information in our written testimony is in your packet, and we respectfully ask for your modification of Condition B and the removal of Condition E. Thank you.
So let me bear down a bit on Question E.
And, yes.
Condition E, my reading of Condition E, and maybe you can refer me to a place in your submission that gets to this question if you have gotten to it in written form, mm-hmm. and that is that Condition E says basically take the historic structures report, implement the short and long-term restoration recommendations and the maintenance issues, including removal of non-historic elements such as light fixtures and conduit and restoration of the contributing resources. I don't read that report, I don't read that condition as saying remove all non-historic elements on the site. I read that condition as saying the removal of non-historic elements mentioned in the report. Are you saying that there are non-historic elements mentioned in the report that you can't remove?
Yes.
Okay, can you give us a listing of those at some point?
Actually, I can. I can give you one example right now. One of the things that's listed is the reservoir liner. If we remove the reservoir liner, the reservoirs will leak. So
that's a non-historic
that's
element.
That's a non-historic element installed in 1990.
In the report.
Yes.
Which reservoir?
Pardon?
Which reservoir liner is supposed to
be? It's the Reservoir 5 liner.
Okay.
Another one would have been the Tabor Pump Station, and we cannot remove that. That feeds about 1,000 people that are a higher elevation than the reservoirs at Mount Tabor, and removal of that would remove their service.
Okay, and that one was also mentioned in the report. I don't have the report.
I don't remember. I think that we interpret the way that condition is that it's saying, in addition to the report, you are removing any non-historic elements. It does not distinguish okay. only those that are listed in the report.
I think that it may be possible to clarify that.
Right.
And that reasonable people might even be able to agree on which elements that are non-historic can be addressed in a restoration effort and which ones have some important practical value, like a pump station, that most reasonable people would agree needs to stay in operation. So I'm hoping that the relatively narrow distance between the two appellants here could get narrower if we were able to agree on the list of things that a reasonable person would say would have to stay, and the ones like out-of-era light fixtures that can relatively easily be replaced.
So, and it might be worth you looking through this report again, because actually the new liner is said to be good for it. Stopped the deterioration and preserve and maintain it.
Okay.
So this obviously wasn't the focus of the land use review for the most part. It
no.
probably would be good over the time that the record is held open to look through it and figure out which things could be done. We could work on that. I have a question on it, though. You said that one of the elements cost four times more than the report suggests, but four times more than 1.5 is 6, not 8 million. How did you get to 8 million?
So one of the elements, so actually that's two different items that were, so let me clarify both of them. There is one, when we restored the Gatehouse 1, it had a, in the report, it had a proposed cost of $35,000 to $50,000. And that was a planning level budget that was developed. It did not include, and it states in the report, it does not include any design or planning design or construction or permitting. It just is a, it's an estimate to figure out whether or not to prioritize projects and decide how to do, which projects to do. That project actually came in a little over $200,000. That's four times what it was done in the planning level. So when we, and in that report, there are a lot of blank lines where there are no dollars listed at all. There, for the dollars that are listed, it's $1.5 million.
Right.
So what we did was we calculated what it would cost to do all the things that didn't have a dollar attached to it, and then we prorated that or projected that forward to $2018 dollars. Since the condition says that we would do the work before 2019, we did future cost and brought that up. Once you applied future cost and all the missing dollars, that brought it up to $8 million.
Well, the missing ones are all just maintenance projects.
Those all cost money, though. And actually, they're not all maintenance projects. There's some that are what they call Category A and Category B projects as well.
Thank you.
Question about the tree mitigation issue that the Mount Tabor Neighborhood Association brought up. Is there a requirement here that, as they described it, to not plant new trees above the new pipeline?
Yes, there is. I'm actually glad you asked that question. Actually, the Water Bureau standard does say for all pipes that we don't allow any kind of trees or landscaping without some kind of a root barrier, root protection within 10 feet of our pipeline on either side. Unfortunately, those trees that are on top of our pipelines at Mount Tabor grew before that standard was developed. But it's been in our standards at least for the 20 years I've been at the Water Bureau. Most of the pipe that we're installing is in roadways, either paved or gravel roadways. There's 25 feet of pipe that goes through a small section of trees. That's the section that they're talking about.
It's not the whole length.
It's not the whole length. The whole length is mostly in roadways. It's 1,500 feet of pipe, and 25 feet go through trees.
Okay, thank you.
But the policy is citywide about water.
Yes, it is.
Policies,
yes.
And trees.
Absolutely.
And trees.
Yep.
Okay. Other questions at this point? Thank you very much.
Well, but I think it's worth, Mayor, just I'm having a blast on the past. So when you say that of the 1,500 feet of pipe, only 25 feet is covered by this, and that's because, as I recall, the proposal that you ultimately submitted rerouted the pipe in response to neighborhood concerns about impact on trees. Am I correct?
That is correct. Though even before that, most of it was under roads and under paved and gravel roads. There were other areas that were not, but in this particular...
But when the issue of impact on trees came up, you made further adjustments.
That's
so
correct.
So that to the extent possible, you protected the trees.
Yes.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, we'll have you back at the end of rebuttal. Thank you very much. Okay, let's call on the Mount Tabor Neighborhood Association again. Keep running those two words together. Something about Taborhood.
Yes.
Works, right?
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Again, for the record, Ty Wyman here as attorney. And I wanted to pick up on a procedural question, at least it's still a question to me. Commissioner Fritz was gracious enough to suggest to us a way in which we could perhaps suggest conditions as a way of avoiding a full-blown conditional use process, and that we might be able to submit later in writing. I saw something today, a slip that mentioned a record open period of June 11th, but I didn't know if that was official.
We have that option, and we might exercise it to keep the record open. And if you want to request that, we can take that request.
Okay. Well, I would have to talk. I'll talk to my client here after we stand down. So at this point, it's still open. whether the record will be left open.
That's correct.
Still unclear.
We have that option, and particularly if a party requests it, we usually grant it.
Yeah. Thank you very much. I know that I understand that my colleagues here have, frankly, they want to rebut some of the evidentiary assertions that you have heard here today, and I'm going to hand it over to Stephanie to start that.
Well, much of the new evidence that you've seen today, we haven't seen. So this is us trying to catch up on the fly, and so we'll do our best. So first, with the assertion Water Bureau made that the 60-day time limit is mathematically impossible, that is completely new information for us. And why, at the Historic Landmarks Commission hearing, the commissioners did ask multiple times what would that process look like and what would it cost. And that data was never once asserted. We also, in other formats, have heard them actually explain that the drain, clean, fill process takes less than a week without overtime pay, and that it would need to happen three times a year, and they've even given us a cost for that. And in fact, in April of 2014, there was an Oregonian article where they were quoted, a Water Bureau staff person was quoted, that they were in the process of draining and cleaning, and then they would refill, and that would take 4 to 6 days.
Stuart, let me follow up on that for a second.
Yes.
Do you believe there's a difference between draining into the sewer system and draining through other pipes, and does that affect the timeline? In other words, one of the things I think they said was it depends on
the different set of pipes.
On what set of pipes?
Yeah.
If it's disconnected from the system, it goes in the sewer system, which has permits because of CSO. Are we talking apples and oranges here?
We may be, but we haven't had a chance to investigate that. And I think we'd like that chance to look at what the difference is between what they've said in the past and what they're saying today. Because what we've got in the record from the past is an understanding, and so did the Historic Landmarks Commission, that what they were trying to protect were those deep iconic views and having them be there regularly when visitors came to the park. So they were under the impression that Water Bureau needed a total of 3 weeks to do the drain, clean, fill, and they doubled that. They very generously doubled that. So this new idea that it might take 77 days to drain really changes the whole concept of how do you not trigger the no adverse effect warning from SHPO if you're taking 77 days to drain the water. I think that needs to be looked at.
And can I ask you a question, though? We're going to, at some point, be discussing one standard versus another. It could be a matter of days or weeks that separate them. I think before we get lost in that, it'd be important for you to state what's the underlying concern you have. We could have a scientist come in and perhaps settle this question to all of our satisfaction. What's your underlying concern?
My underlying concern is that I want these views to be regularly available to citizens when they arrive at our park. And for the last 4 years, these views have not been regularly available. Reservoir 6 has been below half full more often than it has been full. And that's a distressing thing to find for the character of this park.
Can I respond to Commissioner Fisher's question earlier? Because the 4 to 6 days was actually quoted in a newspaper article, and I believe on television, from the Water Bureau, and it was in reference to what we could call the pee incident, which you may recall. And so they were saying, this was in response to how long is it going to take to drain and clean and fill the reservoirs in response to the pee incident. Unless they were draining that peed water into people's water pipes and had already been draining down for, I believe it was 45 days or something before they start actually draining to the sewer system, if they were claiming then that it took 4 to 6 days to drain what they were calling defiled water. So
That is different, as you know. I had something to do with that. The water was drained to another reservoir. It was not introduced into the sewer system, as you know, because the hidden dividend of the decision, which some people thought was boneheaded, was that another water from one reservoir traveled to another.
Okay.
And that is, it wasn't actually discharged into the sewer system because for precisely the reason we don't have the capacity to do that. So it migrated from one reservoir to another, which I think they'll tell you is different than discharging the water.
Okay.
Okay, should I get back to addressing
sure.
the
Please.
Rebuttal points? Okay, so then Commissioner Fritz, you asked us to look at the revised language from Water Bureau for Condition B, and I'm not sure I've seen all of that. Hillary has just shared with me a paragraph, and I'd like a chance to look at that more closely, but the one change I'm seeing in that paragraph is that they're suggesting, other than eliminating this 60-day time limit, that they are suggesting changing the Scrivener's error. Instead of reading 50 to 75%, and we've suggested 65 to 85%, they're suggesting 50 to 85%. I think we're getting really close to each other's points on this point. So while I'd like to check in with my group, I feel like we're coming together. Okay, as to the cost of the historic resource, sorry, the historic
structures
report. We're... We have among our neighbors the one of the experts that actually helped to write this report, and she will be speaking to you later. And so we have some familiarity with this report and the stuff that is in it. And the original quote was for $1.5 million, and now we're hearing from Water Bureau that they estimate this to now be at $8 million. And I'm struck that that seems like a 400% inflation rate between 2009 and today, and I'm not sure how that really pans out. But I would like to quote that from what we've heard for evidence before now, that that this just isn't founded thus far. They haven't produced anything before now or even today that backs up this $8 million and 400% inflation, and I'd really like to see how they came to the $8 million lined out so we could understand that. But beyond that, the HLC had a good reason for mandating this report, and that was because they felt they needed to mandate future behavior, and they felt they needed to mandate future behavior because the code requires them to see enough planning to be certain that what is about to happen with the historic structure is going to meet the approval criteria, and there weren't enough plans provided into the record, so they adopted a plan. And our code, as Ty has said, our code does not allow wiggle room for your budget. You are required to meet the code and make your budget meet what you need to do to meet the code. And to the point of his non-historic elements being making the condition E clause a non-starter, we were under the impression that the non-historic elements that were being requested to be removed would all be the ones that affect the aesthetic of the site, and that that's what was in the report, and that the report would be limited to that. So,
Effie, that sounds to me, listening to the very excellent exchange earlier, to be another one of those issues that could be resolved by putting creating a list of what we're talking about. And I don't see any great enthusiasm on your side to take out a pump if it has some kind of functional purpose or something that prevents a leak. So that sounds to me like the hearing has it surfaced something that we could get some clarification.
I agree with that.
And may I just add on to that? And I tip my hat, frankly, to the Water Bureau for coming up with this argument. But underlying it is, does anybody think that the HLC intended for the liner to be removed or for the non-historic? No, obviously they didn't. That was not the underlying intent of the condition. And I'm afraid with some of the back and forth today, we're getting away from that underlying intent of the Historic Landmarks Commission, and I'm glad we're going to be able to hear directly from some of them. So, John, did you have?
I just want to speak specifically to the question of the Historic Structures Report, because I spent a lot of time looking at that and looking at the math. The Water Bureau at the Historic Landmarks Commission said, well, we've made we are planning to do everything in that report. We've informally adopted the report. We just haven't formally adopted it. And so I actually went through. Tried to use the Water Bureau's own testimony about what they had done so far, and figured out the rate at which they were accomplishing stuff since 2009 May. So 6 years ago, when that report was written, and if they continued under their informal adoption to do things at the same rate of speed that they have been doing them, they would complete the requirements in the Historic Structures Report in 2066. And as I said to the Historic Landmarks Commission, I'm sorry, I'm going to miss the ribbon cutting. I don't know about the rest of you, but we're not going to be there to celebrate when they finish that. There are a ton of things in the Historic Structures Report which are not assigned figures because they are maintenance items, as Commissioner Fritz pointed out. And maintenance, you would think, would be part of what they would normally do, and that they would not add those numbers in order to try to build the number up to $8 million. And there are things that are where it says option A or option B, but those are options. They're option A and option B. And you can do one or the other, but you don't add them together to get the price of what it is that you're going to do. So I will submit, we could have had a very robust discussion about all of this if there had been the kind of public involvement that the City of Portland's public involvement principles call for, which say that early in the planning for a major project, and the Water Bureau keeps saying this is a small project, but for Mount Tabor Reservoirs and Mount Tabor Park, this is an enormous project. If we had been invited to the table to sit down with them to help them think about and plan this project when they started, we might have been able to arrive at something that would have said, yes, let's take care of the structures, let's take care of the water, in that even if it's not going to be potable water, it could still have been there. We wanted the discussion that we're now having in this truncated little 10 minutes on, 10 minutes off conversation. We would have loved to sit down with them and say, look, here's a historic structures report that you commissioned years ago, and very little of it's been done. Could we, could some of that be part of this? And now they're saying the Historic Landmarks Commission, the only way they could get this thing, as you heard from Ms. Adams, the only way the Historic Landmarks Commission could come to an agreement to approve the application was to adopt the Historic Structures Report whole. There was no way for a nuanced parsing of that. We would be happy to sit down, but if you look at it and it's entered into the record, that report is not going to cost $8 million to do. And why would you put it in $2018? You could start tomorrow and do it in $2015. So saying that we're going to wait until the last minute and then we're going to inflate the cost is pretty disingenuous, in my view. I'm sorry.
Thank you. Thank you, John. And I really appreciate your, one, rolling up your shirt sleeves on this issue, and also the tag teaming. We're just kind of doing the best we can here on the fly. I did want to speak to the form and integrity criterion. There are two really relevant criterion, two particularly material criterion. Before you, I emphasize the criterion one, which is a preservation criterion. I think I've heard the Water Bureau sort of emphasize, well, we're not threatening the form and integrity. I frankly don't see that when I see, first of all, the record of the condition of the historic resources out there. Also, maintaining the integrity of something, to me, that's very close to preservation. I don't see a material, in other words, I don't see a material distinction between the two approval criteria that are in play here. So I would just offer you that.
I want to just give you a chance on this because you're the lawyer and the expert. You asked us to ask you questions.
Yeah.
So SHPO says no adverse impact. So at least with respect to the work that the Water Bureau is proposing to do, why isn't that relevant?
Ms. I don't know if you noticed, Ms. Stewart leaned into the microphone. She wants to address this. Can we both quickly?
Sure.
So is that could be evidence of no adverse impact. First of all, the lawyer in me says that's not dispositive of preservation. And secondly, I understand that as an evidentiary matter, that SHPO's statement is somewhat in dispute. Exactly what SHPO was saying there was no adverse effect as to is not this. It does not relate directly to the resources that the criterion protects.
And And if we do keep the record open, which I'm guessing we will, you'll bring that to our attention.
Okay, thank you.
Can I speak on that? Okay, so SHPO said no adverse effect as long as certain negotiated provisions were met by the Water Bureau, and those were negotiations that they had together, SHPO and the Water Bureau, and one of those provisions was you must maintain water in the reservoirs, and the intent behind that provision was to maintain the iconic views. They had other provisions, and some of the correspondence between Water Bureau and SHPO has been revealed to us by SHPO, and that is in the original record with HLC, and I can further bring that to the surface for you later if you'd like. But also, SHPO did choose to respond to Water Bureau's appeal to you because they did notice that their no adverse effect was invoked as a reason for disregarding the Historic Landmarks Commissioner's conditions. And SHPO made it very clear that, first of all, they were reviewing very different criteria. They were reviewing the state-level criteria, which is not as specific or as rigorous as the local criteria. And secondly, that they fully supported HLC's decision because HLC was looking at a much more rigorous criteria, and they supported whatever HLC felt like they needed to do.
Just so we're clear, we can spend a lot of time talking about intent. We can talk a lot about what's in or not in the record. This is there's been many hearings before Landmarks. It's a public hearing now. There's been robust public process before. If there's specific evidence you want to point us to, a letter, a follow-up or something, just if you would do that and with your argument, because that's the most useful information, not speculating about intent. Or if something's omitted from the record, you'll bring that to our attention too. But it's specifically what are the ground rules? We in these kinds of proceedings, we are often in the role of referees as well as decision makers on the merits, and want to make sure the record's full and complete. And then if you have an argument like with SHPO, you'll highlight hopefully the document and make your argument.
One of them is actually in the appeal report that was provided to you a month ago. It might be in front of you today.
Well, we will provide you. I know that you are.
It's not in the record.
I know that you are, and we appreciate that.
You have a lifeline. Thank you.
All right. Any other questions for the Mount Tabor Neighborhood Association? Thank you very much. We'll have you back at the end for a rebuttal, and then we'll begin public testimony. But I do want to give our Historic Landmarks Commission members who are here a chance to come up and speak first, since they dedicate an enormous amount of volunteer hours to the city. We'll give them at least a little bit of thanks for that. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Mayor and Commissioners. We really appreciate your time today and the great dialogue that's going on here. I think it's really informative and substantial. So we wanted to come as
a record.
I'm sorry, I'm Brian Emmerich. I'm the chair of the Portland Historic Landmarks Commission. And to my right, I've got Jessica Engelman, vice chair of the Landmarks Commission. And at the end of the table, Commissioner Harris Matarazzo. So we wanted to be here as a resource for you guys. If you guys have questions for us, a lot of what we've obviously deliberated on and voted on has already been included into the record, and staff went through that. So I don't want to repeat a bunch of those points. I want to hit maybe some key points, though. First, you know, this has been a really difficult process for all parties involved. The Landmarks Commission's deeply concerned about the volume of public opposition in this case and the Water Bureau's dismissal of that opposition. There was, in our opinion, a lack of public process employed by the Water Bureau in comparison to what we saw with the Washington Parks Reservoir. And I think this might go somewhat back to what you had mentioned, Commissioner Fish, with the starting as a type 2 process and then effectively just kind of got thrown into a type 3 process.
No, it didn't get thrown into a type 3.
Steered.
I was steered. Requested. So I have a thick file at home called No Good Deed Goes Unpunished. So I just think, just to be clear on the record, the community asked to have this converted to a type 3. I was under no legal obligation to do so. It was not thrown in. I was persuaded by the arguments by very rational people that are here today that we would all benefit from a more robust public process. And I think that's important, I think, because sometimes we allow our view of the merits of this thing to color the way we characterize the procedure. And in fairness to the people who have been involved both there and here, I think we should be careful.
Okay, I appreciate that clarification. To be clear on our side, I guess it felt like there was less preparation in terms of the process and we are running directly in parallel, essentially, and just behind the Washington Parks Reservoir project, which, you know, to mention too, this is all part of a huge multi-million-dollar water upgrade project for the city of Portland. So it's kind of odd to look at this in just a small little silo like this. And that was part of the context that we were thinking about there. Normally, though, with the Type 3 process, we get a design advice request to the Landmarks Commission. We have a chance for some collaborative dialogue with public input before we really move to a case hearing. In this case, because of the expedited timeframes, they really wanted to move directly just right into the case hearing and quickly through. And for a project of this magnitude, the time frame was really quite compressed. And so that's why, to clarify, that was what my comment was regarding there between the Type 2 to the Type 3.
And the time frame you're referring to is the LT2 compliance time frame.
No, I'm referring to the Landmarks time frame. The Washington Parks reservoirs were probably a year in the making, coming back with multiple sessions and collaborative dialogues with the commission, and this did not go through that same route. So, and in comparison, we actually, although I know you guys had a different experience, when Washington Parks came here, we actually had very little public opposition in those forums and a good discussion, and we felt like they were actually being good stewards of the resource, and were then surprised to find this one going a different direction, essentially, from our perspective. So,
is that because the environmental review had to be done in 120 days? Did that factor into the timeline?
I'm not clear. I understand the Water Bureau was under some challenges with the timeframes that they had to meet, but from our perspective, you know, we didn't get kind of the full normal process that we would usually expect.
You're not normally constrained by the 120-day clock, is that correct?
Correct, yeah.
I think that might have been a factor of having the environmental review bundled into this, that by state law has to be done in a certain time frame.
And that may be the case, too, and I'm sure staff could talk more about the legalities of that side than I could. So,
and by the way, on the question that you make, the point you make about public process collaboration, when we got the report on Washington Park, it was an entirely different exercise. The report from the commission, the testimony that I could at least hear during that hearing, or when it came to us. And so, regardless of the outcome of this proceeding, I think it's worth debriefing that at some point, because you're the ones on the ground dealing with this in the first instance, and all bureaus could learn from a better, I think, public process.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's true. And I would say, you know, what we saw with Washington Parks is the understanding that this was a historic resource of huge magnitude to the city and interest to the citizens, and it was treated that way with a very thoughtful approach and more of a dialogue coming back and forth, whereas with the Mount Tabor one, what we saw was just kind of a, well, we're just going to disconnect it, leave them essentially as they are, and so there's really no adverse effect, and here's the letter from SHPO stating that so long as the water's in the reservoir, you know, and you really can't see much, we really haven't changed the historic resource. And when we asked the Water Bureau how were they practically going to achieve this goal, we really found their answers to be lacking, to be frank, which was, you know, how long is it going to take to refill the reservoirs? And we've heard some discussion on that already. And my understanding was 2 to 3 weeks. When they testified earlier, I heard 77 days to drain them down, 14 days to clean, 7 days to refill. That's 98 days total, not 2 or 3 weeks. And when I asked how often they were going to have to do that each year to be able to maintain the quality of the water, it was 3 to 4 times a year. So that's doesn't add up with 98 days per cycle. And as was mentioned earlier, we had the peeing incident last year. And there was a lot of press over draining one reservoir and refilling that. And now we're talking about draining three reservoirs 3 to 4 times a year. And what is the environmental cost of that in terms of our perception of the city? And also financially, what is the cost of that? It doesn't seem like a sustainable approach. That really gets beyond the purview of the Landmarks Commission. So that's why I'm bringing that point to you guys, because it hasn't really been discussed here. And it feels like there's just really a lack of planning and that these could become the most expensive water features in city history. So is that really, is there a big plan behind this? And that's really a part of why we were concerned, and also hearing the concerns of the citizens on the maintenance record of the reservoirs, and really wanting to make sure that those reservoirs were protected going forward and not going to be essentially a water container that was then going to be discarded because it no longer had a utilitarian function.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Good afternoon.
I don't really have any prepared remarks. Again, more here to be a resource. Sorry, Jessica Ingeman, Vice Chair, Landmarks Commission. The comments from the Mount Tabor Neighborhood Association characterizing sort of our views and expressions during our hearings, I would say, are very accurate, and especially the discussion of the two approval criteria related to preserve the historic character and the form and integrity of the resource. We were not just willy-nilly trying to attach any, you know, plan or historic structures report to that. There were approval criteria in mind that we were wanting to assure that this project would be able to meet both in the short and the long term. And so, hence, without any prior planning, the best that we could do was to take the historic document that was in place and try to fold that into the conditions as a way to ensure the long-term preservation of the resource.
Well, Harris, you may be prepared to talk about condition E, but if you're not, I wanted to throw that out there to the three of you, and that is, it seems to me that the council may be called on here either to interpret or maybe to clarify what you intended with condition E, and that is this requirement to implement the restorative recommendations and maintenance recommendations, including the removal of non-historic elements such as light fixtures and conduit. Again, I read that meaning if you're restoring a historic structure and there are non-historic light fixtures and conduit on the outside of it, take them off and replace them with period equipment. But we've heard an interpretation from the Water Bureau saying, well, that might mean we have to remove pump houses. Could you elaborate on what you intended with condition E?
Yeah, I mean, it was the former, not the latter. So, and lacking a better tool, which, again, an applicant could have brought to the hearing of here are the things we propose to do, we were left with having to adopt a report, which the Water Bureau has, the neighborhood testified, had said they'd already essentially adopted, just not officially. So the intent was really to get rid of the security lighting, which was no longer to be required because they're no longer, public water, and remove some of the effects over time of, like, the conduit and things like that. Not go in and, take out functional elements of the water system or pump houses or things of that nature, so...
Thank you. Harris, welcome.
Thank you. Harris Matarazzo, Landmarks Commissioner. I would reiterate what has been said, and I won't repeat that by my fellow commissioners, but I would just like you to know what you probably already do, and that is that we met on at least three different occasions. I've heard four, but I think it was only three, to consider this matter. It was very contentious, probably the most contentious commission meeting I have ever been at, and I attribute that largely to a lack of communication between the parties, and I'm sorry to say that. We initially split, I believe, at our second meeting as to what to do. We split 3-3, and at that time, I asked the parties, we called them up, as we spoke to them, I asked them each if they would be willing to submit to some kind of mediation, some kind of dispute resolution, non-binding, just to talk. And the Neighborhood Association and others agreed the Water Bureau would not make that kind of a commitment, and this, again, was non-binding, and that, to me, really... caused me to think in a much different way about what was before us. And I think, frankly, again today, when we're, for the first time, this commission is hearing about, as Brian was talking about, costs and timelines to drain reservoirs, the removal of pumps, which would obviously make the vessel one that couldn't be used as a reservoir. I mean, none of that stuff was brought up, and certainly there was a time and occasion to do that. And frankly, it's very disheartening, disconcerting. It really wastes all of our time as commission members. And I don't want to ascribe any bad intent to anybody, but I have seen here something that I probably would never wish to be involved in again as a commission member. And I, frankly, if I ever had any aspiration to be a city council member, I would, those hearings would have completely eliminated that. It was really that horrible of an experience, and frankly, a sad one, because this was not a dispute between neighbors, but a city agency and the people it serves.
Hey, folks, please, let's not, no applause, thumbs up are fine, thank you.
Anyway, just briefly, condition B about the maintenance of the water of the reservoir's water level,
go ahead, he's answering a question, that's fine, go ahead.
That was included because of concerns that the reservoir not turn into a skateboard park or something like that, that in fact, actually it's there, not only was built as a utility, but also as an aesthetic destination, and that by maintaining a certain level of water there, the aesthetic portion of its purpose could be maintained. And also there was we talked a lot about filling and refilling the reservoir, so this is not a new issue because we didn't want it to become a mosquito breeding ground. The water needs to be refreshed periodically. And so we've believed as a commissioner, at least I'm speaking for myself, I believed as a commissioner that without a detailed plan to make sure that that water was maintained at historic levels, that we would be that somebody would be back before you or in court or some other way, and it needs to be resolved at this level and eliminated as an issue. On the matter of Condition E, the implementation of the May 9, 2009 Mount Tabor Reservoir's Historic Structures Report, again, it's been spoken to, but here's this report. It's out there. It hasn't really been implemented, and it needs to be. Frankly, the Water Bureau is tasked with providing clean water to our citizens. It is really not in the business of historic preservation, and I believe as a commissioner it really should not be in that business because it's not part of its mission. It does what it does very, very well, and we're lucky to have them, but it really needs to be removed from their oversight, in my opinion, and this maintenance plan needs to be implemented, and there needs to be some kind of oversight. If Water Bureau is continuing to do it, they need to do it with some kind of a plan to make sure that it gets done. Thank you very much.
Thank you. One comment. Other questions, Mayor? Please.
And I was hoping I wouldn't have to make this comment, but Harris, I'm the fourth commissioner in charge of the Water Bureau in 2.5 years. And so I'm not going to make this comment because I feel obliged to defend the Water Bureau for all the events of the last decade or beyond. But I will tell you, I think it's a bit disingenuous to say that you didn't understand why there's some conflict over this issue. And in the defense of the Water Bureau, it is the City of Portland that has set the policies with respect to the future of the Mount Tabor Reservoirs, not the Water Bureau. It is the City of Portland that's negotiated timelines with the EPA on LT2, not the Water Bureau. It is the City of Portland that has made the policy decisions, consistently putting the Water Bureau in the front lines of a very contentious debate, probably the most contentious debate I've ever seen. So I would just say, in defense of the Water Bureau, can any bureau do public process better? Yes. Your comments about how to make this a more fruitful proceeding administratively at Landmarks is important. But I think it's very unfortunate to demonize the Water Bureau in this dispute. There is a fundamental disagreement in our community about the future of the reservoirs, and I respect both sides of that debate. I respect the people that are here that have passionately fought against every step of the decommissioning of the reservoirs. But that is the underlying history of this, and Commissioner Fritz and I were at a public forum that was shut down because people didn't want to have a discussion around community process.
Not true.
It is true. And so what I would say to you is to leave that context out, I think, is unfortunate. And to disparage the Water Bureau, I think, is unfair. Can we do better? Can the Bureau do better? Sure. But again, I'm the fourth commissioner in 2.5 years. What's helpful to us at this proceeding is not making comments like that, but is addressing the merits of the dispute, because that's how we have to decide, not who wears who's the good guy or the bad guy in the equation. And I regret we go there, Mayor, and I don't think it's appropriate for this hearing to develop a record in that respect.
Well, if I may respond,
sure.
I certainly appreciate everything you said, and that was not my purpose to disparage the Water Bureau. But let me tell you something that came up. And first of all, I understand that we're a quasi-judicial agency, and I'm just giving you my opinion, and you can take a look at the testimony that I've submitted today. I certainly understand the EPA issues. That is beyond our purview. The thing that, and I went into this with a completely open mind, but it began to change when the Water Bureau admitted on the record that it had refused to engage with the citizenry, and I don't understand that. I'm not trying to demonize the Water Bureau. What I'm trying to say is open dialogue needs to occur, and I don't think that happened in this situation, and I would ask you to, if you wanted to review the oral record that was made, that was really very telling for me.
And we have that here, so that's helpful.
We have that, so thank you.
And I mean no disrespect, and I appreciate your willingness to make your comments to me.
Thank you. Well, we appreciate through you and the rest of your colleagues on the commission for all the hours you put on these cases. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you all very much.
Thank
you. Let's move on into the sign-up sheet then, please.
The first three people, number 1, 2, and 3, are Marianne Schwab, Mark Bartlett, and John Logan. And they'll be followed by number 4, 5, and 6, Steve Gordon, Steve Wax, and Eileen Brady.
And you got the last word on the budget, and you get the first word on this. I don't know how you do it.
Well, there are no cookies, though, today.
Before everybody starts, how many do we have signed up, Carla?
About 40, I think.
About 40 people signed up.
2 minutes apiece.